Digging through the past is not that hard. Rusted cars and broken shards. Mining memories in an old wrecking yard. Echoes of laughter, whispers of pain. Time stands still, but the memories remain. In this graveyard of steel, I find my guard.
Welcome to the Wrecking Yard. I'm Jerry Wayne Longmire, and y'all are presumably still y'all. All are welcome here in the Church of Internal Combustion. We just ask that you show up with an open heart. My goodness. Sorry. Sunglasses on. It's my bad, John. You got me in eyeglasses today. I don't usually like to wear my eyeglasses on camera because they reflect the lights that I have failed to turn on. Here we go. Boy, I am batting 1,000 today, ain't I? There we go. Now we got some little bit of illumination in our space. I don't like to wear my glasses on camera. I really don't like to wear my glasses at all when I can help it. But the older I get, the more I find I need them. I usually wear contact lenses, which if you've worn those for any period of time, you know they can be a booger sometimes. A couple of nights ago, I tied one on a little bit, had a little bit to drink, and in the process of hanging out on the porch with my lovely lady, I rubbed Coleman Deep Free Insect Repellent into my contacts, and my eye has just been a booger for a couple of days. If you saw my last Faulkner, the one about the mosquitoes, I'm squinting my eye the whole time because it's just jacked up. You know, I'm not imitating a pirate, just jacked my eyeball up. Little insect repellent. It'll happen. It'll happen to the best of us. Some changes this week. I was signed up with a service, and this is mostly just you audio viewers. I mean, audio listeners, audio viewers. How does that work? Mostly for the people that listen to this on audio. It's still going to be available in all the same places, but we left our contract with a company called Believe and with Cumulus. And it was nothing, no hard feelings against guys, whatever. It just wasn't working out for me. But there was just so much complaint about the commercials. And I went and tried to listen to it on audio, and it was so bad. There was just, the ad placement wasn't working right in the software or something, but I was getting cut off, and there was just so many ads per episode. And we were getting a lot of complaints about it. And realistically, in 6 months, that paid me a very small sum of money that is not worth my fans having a disappointing experience to me. So we broke away clean, and we're all still friends, and everybody still gets along. And you know, who knows what we may do in the future, but that just didn't feel like it was working anymore. And I just didn't want to put people through it anymore. You know, this should just be an easygoing thing. I can't do anything about the ads on YouTube, but that is also part of what pays my bills. So if I didn't do some ads, I would have to charge to listen to this thing, and I don't want to do that. So, there's a little bug here crawling around. If I get my hands on him, I'm going to squash the piss out. That is the goal. Get the old air conditioner over here. Get a little cold breeze blowing up my skirt. It is a balmy 90 degrees in the shop, but this air conditioner is blowing 62 right up my britches, so that's nice. It's been a crazy week. Colorado was amazing. Colorado trip was phenomenal. I told you guys, I have my main goal was just to take my kids on this huge road trip. We did 21 or 2,200 miles in 4 days in that little Volkswagen Atlas I rented, which is just a spectacular little machine. I got some bitches about it, but they're few and far in between, and a lot of them just bitches about everything that's going on with cars these days. I just need cruise control to run the gas. I don't need you to run the brakes and tell me when to slow down and all that kind of bullshit, cruise control. I just need you to keep the car moving at a steady speed until I tell you to quit doing that. That's all I need cruise control to do. And that car communicated with me more than people I owe money it was just, I don't need a car. I'm not looking for a relationship that intimate with the vehicle. We don't need to speak that often. I just need to be able to drive you and go do my trip. That's all I need to do. I don't need to communicate with you at all times, and certainly don't need you checking in on me because I may have went over 85 miles an hour too many times for your good feelings. But, you know, you can get out there in New Mexico. There's a straightaway when you pull out of Texas, right, when you come through text line and you're headed to Raton Pass. And there's a straightaway, and they call it a safety corridor, you know. And the wind, on the way back, the wind was whipping through there pretty good. I didn't speed. But on the way out there, it was a clear, perfect day with no wind. And, boy, adi, 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 let's go. That little 2-liter and that Atlas will get it done. 279 horsepower. That little booger will get up and go. That was a fun little machine to drive. And some 50 just handled perfectly through the mountains. You know, going through Raton Pass was always a mess. And, I mean, just everywhere we went, that little booger was just a joy to drive. I truly enjoyed that trip. Didn't yell. I got tense with one of my youngest at one point on the way there. But he was just tired, and I recognized it. We backed out, you know, we got him situated. But it was a long time for kids to be in the car, long time. And on the way back, we just did it Ironman. Me and Rachel, we got up about 9 o'clock in the morning, left Colorado Springs, shagged ass. I drove all the way to Amarillo. Mama took over in Amarillo so I could be there with you guys in the podcast last week. And then I took over about 2 hours outside of Houston. We got home 2 or 3 in the morning. And them kids were great. They, you know, they entertained themselves. My oldest kid mostly listened to music all the time, did their own thing. Noah was, I got no complaints, man. It leaves us open to do a lot more of this stuff together in the future, especially like around my shows and shit. Shows in Colorado, big thank you to everybody who came out to that Fort Collins show. Y'all don't know how bad I needed that show. I needed a packed room and a comedy club with low ceilings and an intimate feeling. And my God, that show. I was working out the beats of the new special, and I just couldn't be more pleased with the direction it's taken. The second responder bit is so much better now. I've added a new bit about it's all flowing in a way. I changed up the order a bunch. I was really, really happy with it. Colorado Springs, one of the more interesting shows I've ever done. It was a burlesque club. So there was a lot of naked women in and out of my green room all night, which was, you know, it was fine. I used to work at strip clubs and stuff, so that stuff doesn't really do much for me. But a little distracting, or just a little different feeling than a normal comedy show. Also, the place was haunted, and the wireless mic. I hate wireless mics. I hate wireless mics. Wireless mics are the worst thing that has ever happened to stand-up comedy. I hate them. I'm about to put in my contract. From now on, I want a wired mic. I don't care how much money you spent on your wireless mic. I've used them, high-dollar ones, and I've used cheap ones, and they all screw up a punchline the exact same way. Just wireless mics, use them for your stage, whatever they're good for. They're not good for stand-up comedy. I want a wired mic. Wired mic, if it's messing up, you jiggle the cord. Go on with your set. But it doesn't cut out those wireless mics. I fought that wireless mic that whole show at Colorado Springs. Still had a great show. One of my fans that came out in Colorado Springs turned out to be a young man that saw me perform in Djibouti, and he had never got to see me do all the material that I'm doing right now about my Africa trip because I wrote all that on that trip. And so he was just tickled pink. It's good to see him. Another fan, I forgot to bring it out here with me. She sketched me while I was on stage, and her name is Leah. And it's just so cool, man. I've got it in there set up as I'm gonna frame it and set it up maybe here in the wrecking yard, maybe in my office in there so I can just look at it. I was just real happy with it. Colorado trip was fantastic. Guys, everything is popping right now. I am sitting, I'm spinning a little bit. A lot of my dreams are very close to being able to grab a hold of them. Very close. I can't talk about none of it yet, but I can just say that there's a lot going on at the Longmire household, and you guys will be the first ones to know. And I can't talk about any of it, but I can smell my dream. That's how close it is right now. I can smell what I've been working for. And the book stuff is going amazing. The editor that, you know, found me and decided he wanted to work with me, his name's Adam, and I've told you guys about him before, but he's just a fantastic human being. I've come to really enjoy him as a person, and I'm loving working with him. And that is making that aspect, because we're about to go hunker down boot camp style and get this book done, because their publishing companies won't push up the release of the book, and there's a lot of reasons for that, and there's a lot of cons. You know, I might have to really stick to my fitness stuff and keep myself grounded, and because it's going to be a little bit of a, you know, this we're doing it's time to do 714s, you know what I mean? It's the end of the turnaround. We're trying to get this done under, it's time to do 714s. So it's exciting, but it's a lot of work about to come down the pipe. But I'm telling you, the phone conversations and the conversations my manager has had this week have been absolutely insane. The Houston Chronicle did a story on me, which really, really just blew my mind. It's a huge newspaper, but also it's my hometown. And you never get love in your hometown. And not only are they excited, I'm going to do a TV show this week. It's a local Houston show called Houston Life, but I've been booked to come appear on that show and tell them a little bit about my journey and what all is going on and the book release and the shows, of course, at the Houston Punchline, which I hope are selling good. I'm afraid to ask. But everything is just... I appreciate all of y'all that put positive energy behind me, because I think it's freaking working. It's the only way I can explain it. I have hit some lucky streak lately. And I can tell you part of what happened is I got real sad about them damn cats. I got real sad about that little old cat possum. I had gotten real attached to him already. And I try not to get attached to animals for that reason, because they don't live long enough, especially when crap like that happens. But I got real sad, and sometimes I get real sad, I get real creative, because my brain doesn't want to be sad. So my brain's like, let's do all these other things so we don't have to deal with all these other things we're thinking right now. And it's kind of put me in a creative overload, and it's phenomenal. It's paying off in dividends. So I'm really, really excited about everything that's coming down the pipe. And you guys, my day ones, y'all are going to be the ones. Y'all gonna be the first ones to know. Started everything. The Driven Dreams. DrivenDreams.org. You guys are holy cow. Well, we got two huge packages at the post office when we got back to Colorado this week that I'll open up later. Sound like Hot Wheels, though. Sound like Hot Wheels. So I'm just really excited, because it looks like we're about to get to do a whole lot of good here in my little stretch of the woods. And I'm real excited about that. Couldn't be more thankful to you guys for participating in it, those of you that can. And it's just, it is really, I'll be honest with you, I was feeling pretty dark after all the stuff with the cats happened. I was feeling pretty dark about where me and my family that I live in. And then these boxes just keep coming in with these Hot Wheels for these kids, and it just keeps opening my heart back up. And I thank y'all so much for doing that. It's a beautiful thing. Excited today's episode. We're gonna have a good time. Let's do a quick little sponsor copy. I still don't have any sponsors. I don't care. But I do care, but it's just part of it. Seems to be about this time of year, it's always hard to lock down sponsors. Anyways, if you got a business or a brand and you're looking to get it in front of If you got a business or a brand, you're looking to get it in front of real folks who actually listen, I want to help you do that. The Wrecking Yard is one of the fastest growing shows out there, maybe about to grow a whole bunch more. We average 8,000 to 10,000 downloads a week, 11% engagement rate. We're on all podcast platforms, and we broadcast live in video on YouTube. The folks who tune in, they're loyal, they're sharp, they love getting a glimpse of the real me, they like lessons from the junkyard. And when I talk about a product I believe in, people pay attention. And right now, we've got a handful of sponsor spots open. Your name, your logo, even your hat or your shirt, front and center on a podcast that's already been signed for a book deal and option for TV and film. That sounds like your kind of ride. Email jwlcomedy@gmail.com and let's grow together. My motto is all ships rise. That's jwlcomedy@gmail.com. Excited to, I don't have a personal relationship with this car, but I am a fan of Cadillac. So I'm enjoying days. And really, I picked this car because I just wanted to tell a story about this trip I took and spent with Ralphie May and Lana Turner one time, way back in the day. It kind of falls into play too. I told you guys, I'm scared to put the wrong juju on shit, you know? I've been very close to my career a number of times, and a number of times it's not worked out. And I just perceive it's always not going to work out until the minute it does, you know? And I have no control over that. All I can do is just keep dusting myself off and keep taking another stab at it. And that's basically what this whole podcast has been about. If you've been paying attention from day one, all I've been telling you guys, the whole, if there's a motto to the whole show, is you can't screw up bad enough not to rewrite your story and try some more. And that's why I tell you about all my screw ups. And I'm going to continue telling them about them so that when you do see something pop for me, you go, well, damn, boy, he sure tried a lot until he got there. You know what I mean? Ralphie had this theory that it took 18 to 20 years to be an overnight success in stand-up comedy. And he would talk about this. I know I've told you guys about this, but he would say, you know, look at, I can't remember his name, Lisa Lampanelli and Larry the Cable Guy, Jeff Foxworthy, Dane Cook. All these guys, when they popped, were about 18 years in. All of them, when they blew up overnight, they were 18 years into this business. Well, I'm 21 years into this business, but I took like 2 or 3 years off because I was going through some stuff. So it puts me a little behind. So I think I'm hitting my 18-year mark. So old Ralphie might be on something. I don't know. Let's get into it. Y'all listen here for a second. There's some vehicles that blend into traffic so good you'd swear they're wearing camouflage paint. And then you have the Cadillac Escalade. You can't not see an Escalade. It's big, it's brash, it's been in more rap videos than some rappers. And it's become one of the most famous, and let's be honest, sometimes infamous, luxury SUVs in the world. Today, I want to take y'all on a little journey through time. From the Escalade's slightly awkward birth in the late 90s, all the way to its current state as an electric spaceship that costs more than my damn house. To be fair, most cars cost more than my house now. Grab your coffee or your whiskey or your Four Loko, no judgment here. Let's talk about how Cadillac climbed up the luxury ladder, one chrome inch at a time. Late 90s, United States, SUVs were hotter than a welder's torch. Folks wanted luxury, but they also wanted to sit tall, see over traffic, haul kids, dogs, maybe a boat. Mercedes jumped in with the M-Class. Lexus showed up with the LX. Range Rover was still doing its British off-road aristocrat thing. But the real shot across the bow for Cadillac was the Lincoln Navigator in 1998. The Navigator comes swaggering in the room like a football player in a tuxedo. Stole the show. Big, bold, leathered up, chrome shining like a disco ball. Cadillac, meanwhile, was still sitting there with sedans that still smelled like Meemaw's perfume. GM said, we got to get something in showrooms fast. And boy, they weren't kidding. They went from green light to rolling off the line in 10 months. That's less time than it takes me to return a call from my insurance guy. So the Cadillac was born for the 1999 model year. Let's just call a spade a spade. The first Escalade was pretty much just a GMC Yukon Denali wearing a Cadillac badge. Same frame, same 5.7 liter Vortec V8, 255 horsepower, which sounds decent until you realize the Navigator was cranking out 300 horses from its 5.4 liter Intech V8. And that Lincoln had 365 foot-pound of torque, while the Escalade had to make do with a good bit less grunt. Wasn't exactly a fair fight. Visually, you'd be hard-pressed to tell it apart from a Yukon, unless you know your grills and badges. Cadillac's version had smooth cladding and the crest on the fenders, but otherwise it was Denali DNA all the way. But step inside, and Cadillac tried to Cadillac-ify the inside. The Denali already was cool on the inside. Denali already had cool touches like two-tone leather, real Zebrano wood, chromed interior handles, and broader door panels. Cadillac took that and added even more wood trim, unique leather seats with Cadillac logos stitched into the headrest, and a fancier center console. And they loaded it. They loaded it up. Chrome 16-inch wheels, a Bose Acoustimass sound system with a six-disc changer, heated front and rear seats, auto-dimming mirrors, fog lights, you name it. Those Escalades had it all. Problem was, it just didn't feel that different from the Denali. And with a fuel economy at 11 miles per gallon in the city and 15 on the highway, it wasn't exactly winning Eco Awards either. The colors, Cadillac's kind of boring about colors sometimes. They had silver sand metallic, sable black, aspen white, Bordeaux red, all of them classy, but let's face it, they were just various shades of beige and gray, except the red and the black. Fun fact I found out while researching the Escalade is GM still owns the very first Escalade ever built. It's a 1999 Aspen White one with the VIN number 400001 sitting nice and pretty in their heritage collection. I thought that was kind of cool. Well, what it cost to get your hands on that bad boy. 2002, we get our first look at the real, what the Cadillac Escalade is going to be. This is where things start getting spicy. Cadillac rolled out the second gen Escalade in 2002. And this time, they weren't just badge engineering. They was coming for Lincoln Navigator blood. They built it on GM's new GMT 820 platform. This Escalade had sharper lines, a bolder stance, and a front grille so big you could hang Christmas lights on it. Gone was the 5.7. Instead, you could get the 5.3 liter V8 if you were cheaping out, but if you're serious about flexing, you wanted the high output 6-liter Vortec V8. By mid-2005, the 6-liter was standard across the board. That sucker gave the Escalade some genuine hustle. I'm not a big fan of the 6-liter, and I mentioned that before. I would rather have had one with the 5.3 in it myself. I think the 5.3 is such a better engine than the 6-liter. I never known anybody had a 6-liter that just didn't end up with all kind of problems with it at some point. So that's been my experience. Your mileage may vary. I'm sure it will. There's always an exception to the rule. But it was just, Cadillac wasn't just competing at this point. They were setting the tone. They dropped the Escalade ESV in 2003. It's a stretch vehicle, limo and SUV clothes. Thing was long enough to have its own zip code. And then by 2003, the Escalade was just blinged out all the way. By 2003, Cadillac was throwing every luxury gadget they could think of into the Escalade. Four-wheel Stabilitrack stability control, which I have mixed feelings about it, because Mine's not working right now. HID headlights, power adjustable pedals, turn signal mirrors. And my personal favorite, Cadillac stuck a Bulgari branded clock on the dash because, you know, why not? It's a freaking Cadillac, man. 2004, they took it further. They dropped the Platinum Edition Escalade ESB. Base price back then, about 71 grand. That's over $118,000 now, though, thanks to inflation. And Cadillac made damn sure you felt fancy. Factory installed 20-inch chrome wheels. First luxury SUV to pull that particular move. Now they all got them. Chrome grille, lowered suspension, ebony and shell dashboard, heated and cooled cup holders, heated and cooled seats front and back, moonroof, second and third row entertainment screens. I don't know if you've been in one. I've ridden around in one of those. They are a fine, fine machine. I've often studied on trying to find me one. It's a rolling lounge, basically. They did an interior facelift. The audio systems offered a touchscreen GPS nav option. Rear seat DVD system with wireless headphones, which your kids could just watch Shrek on a loop without driving you insane. They relocated the OnStar controls from the dash to rear view mirror because Cadillac loves hiding buttons in weird places. Seat designs changed. They switched out to the fancier burl wood, got away from the Sobrano wood, and I don't even know why I wrote that down because that's stupid. Cadillac had improved another one-inch chimes plate. Doesn't matter. I don't even want to talk about that. I wrote that down for some reason, but that's stupid. Somewhere in this timeline, though, the Escalade turned into a cultural icon. It wasn't just Mama and Granddaddy's Cadillac no more. Rappers name-dropped it. Athletes rolled up in it. Wall Street guys in suits rolled up in it. It wasn't just a luxury SUV. It became a statement. If you wanted folks to know you made it, or at least pretended you made it, the Escalade was part of that formula. And let's be honest, in the 2000s, an Escalade in pearl white on chrome 22s was practically mandatory for half the folks shooting music videos. Fast forward to the current day. The fifth generation Escalade dropped in 2021, and it's freaking enormous. Almost 2 meters tall. It's like rolling down the street in a luxury skyscraper. Technology through the roof, massive curved OLED display screen stretching across the dashboard, the Super Cruise hands-free driving system, night vision cameras, 36-speaker AKG studio sound system, augmented reality navigation, which I don't know what that is. I tried to read about it, and it sounds like something I don't want. It's wild. Cadillac has basically decided to put a spaceship on wheels and call it the Escalade. Not everybody's happy about the size. Critics like The Verge have been throwing shade, calling it a pedestrian hazard. And I get it. You park that thing next to my wife's Cadillac, and it's like Godzilla looming over Tokyo. Now they've dropped the Escalade IQ, and I know a lot of people are against EVs, and I have mixed feelings about EV vehicles. I think EV technology can be really important and really helpful in a number of ways, and I think there's a lot of vehicles that it goes well in. I don't think the SUV, now I ain't driven one, I ain't operated one, so I'm just talking out of what I know about things. But and I get it. They're shooting for that luxury EV territory. They're promising massive range, insane tech, and enough torque to tow your cabin cruiser and look good doing it. But also starts around $130,000, and I just can't wrap my head around that. I mean, I can't wrap my finances around it. But I damn sure can. Could, even if I could, I couldn't wrap my head around it. It's a sign of the times, I guess. Even the ultimate gas guzzling chrome loving icon has got to go electric, so because that's the new cool thing. I don't know. Whether folks will embrace an electric Escalade the way they did the roaring V8 versions, we'll have to wait and see. But I suspect they're not going to. The EVs and heavy trucks and SUVs have not been well received, and it feels like they should just pay attention to what's happening in the market. So there you got it. From a humble, badge engineered beginning to hip hop legend status, to a tech-laden future. The Escalade has climbed higher than anyone probably expected when it first rolled off that Arlington assembly line. Is it excessive? Sure. Is it practical for most people? Absolutely not. But it's Cadillac, baby. It's never supposed to be practical. It's supposed to make you feel like you're king of the road. And if you ask me, the Escalade has well earned its place in automotive history. Turned that whole company around. Now, the reason I chose a Cadillac Escalade is because it's the vehicle I most associate with somebody who was once my real good friend, comedian Ralphie May. Ralphie May was a giant. I'm not talking about his size. Ralphie was too big for the stage. And when I say too big, he had too much heart and too much talent. And too much of just sheer natural ability. He was just too big for any stage he was ever on. I'm not making fun of his size at all. I wouldn't do that. But he had a big old heart, and he was a really kind, kind, gentle human being that I miss the dude, and I'm very grateful for all the good memories I have with him, and I wanted to share one with y'all. And it's really one of my first times spending time with the guy. I started comedy in 2004 at the Laugh Stop, and I told y'all, you know, how that story went. I shot up quick. I got a lot of attention really fast. People liked what I was doing. They thought I was funny. I was slaying crowds, and I was learning. So I was doing on-the-job learning, but and I was bumping hard in Houston, and I was getting road gigs. But I literally, I've told y'all the story about how I met Ralphie. I went to see him, one of the few comics I ever bought a ticket to go see. Went to see him with a girl I was dating and told him how bad I wanted to be a comic. And fanboyed him pretty bad after the show when I was buying his DVD. And he signed that DVD, show up on Monday night, don't be a puss. And I showed up that next Monday night at open mic, did my first open mic ever. And I was bit. Once I was bit, it was just like a good drug. I'm going to be doing a lot more of this. And I'm going to check the timer. I was hooked. But the crazy thing was less than maybe 4 or 5 months after I really got started doing comedy and working for the club, still in late 2004, I was already working for the comedy club, doing shows for the club, getting paid. Ralphie came back in town. And this is right after Last Comic Standing. He's the hottest thing. He's the hottest thing going right now. Everybody wants him. And he come back in town, and he let me work on a show with him. And I got to hang out with him a little bit. And he was just a good dude. And he gave me a lot of good advice about my act. And a lot of ball busting too. But, you know, it's Ralphie's way. About a year later, we're getting ready to hold auditions for Last Comic Standing. Show's still going. I think it's the 2006 season. I can never remember. I feel like this all happened in 2005. But Ralphie comes through town. Doesn't play that club. Plays a different club. Casually mentions to the owner of the Laugh Stop at the time that he's going to be involved with the new season of Last Comic Standing. One of the former placeholders. And the owner of the club said, Jerry Wayne's hitting on all cylinders right now. I'm going to convince him to go audition for Last Comic Standing. They were holding some auditions in San Antonio. Now, the way the auditions work for Last Comic Standing, there's one audition that you guys get to see in the show, and that's the cattle call. And that's where every comedian that can get a plane ticket to get to one of these cities where they're holding auditions gets to that city. And basically, you just wait in line like cattle and hope that you get picked. And be honest with you, most of why they do that, excuse me, is that's where they get a lot of their outtakes, and they're looking for messy people, people that are going to be a spectacle. They're not, a lot of the comics get a separate audition, and that's where an agent or somebody recommends you to the show. And that's what Ralphie offered me. Ralphie contacted me. He said, hey, man, he said, if you're serious about wanting to do this year, buy you a plane ticket to Tempe, Arizona. I think it was in June. Maybe have been later than that. Buy you a plane ticket, Tempe, Arizona. I got you once you get here. I'll pick you up. Me and Lana will pick you up at the airport. We're going to be in Tempe all week. He was playing the improv where they were doing the auditions. Ralphie said, I'm going to get you an audition with the producers of the show. And dream come true, right? Y'all don't know how hard I had to scrounge up by a $180 airplane Southwest ticket, though. And this is in the days of my suit with the Naga hide on my Dwight Yoakam suit, buddy. That suit was everything to me. I wore that suit every time I went on stage in white snakeskin boots. And I scrounged. I did bartending work and everything until I had enough money and I bought that ticket. And then I waited, wondering if all my dreams are about to come true. Because you can't help but think those things. That's why I'm much more grounded these days, because I've been through this a bunch of times. But I was excited. I thought, man, maybe this is my break. Maybe I just get mine earlier than everybody else. You know, you always want a shortcut. Everybody wants to get through without having to pay the dues. It's real damn hard to do. Only person ever do it, Nick Schwartzen. Nick Schwartzen blew up in 4 years, and nobody knows how the shit he did it. Everybody else, 18 years in. You know, Matt Rife, that kid's, you know, coming up on 18 years, or if he's not already. Been doing it since he was very young. That's what happened to Dane Cook. He started real young and paid his dues, got in. Not necessarily saying I'm a fan, but I'm just saying the dude paid his dues. I was bartending at the late night pie. And then I was also, one of my jobs back then was I did maintenance on the club. Last Stop Comedy Club was about 30 years old. So the toilets were constantly breaking. The urinals were constantly needing gaskets. And the damn stalls were getting broken and busted by drunk people. Stuff in the showroom, tables were getting broken by drunks. And there was just always work to do there. And the place always needed a little more touch, a little more paint here, a little more something here. And so I spent most of my days at the Laugh Stop. I spent most of my days up there about 8 o'clock in the morning doing whatever jobs the owner wanted done, learning how to work on urinals, how to take them apart, rebuild the valves on them, all that stuff. I was just doing it because it kept me in some money, but it also kept me right there at the club all the time. I would get done with work, put on my nice clothes, and then hang around just in case I could get a guest spot or get a little stage time. And I did that. I lived at that club. So if everybody say, oh, I shot up fast and everything, and you think maybe it came too easy to me, it wasn't because it was coming too easy to me. It's because I was there all the time. I kept myself in position to get on stage several times a week, didn't hurt that the owner liked me, but I was funny. If I hadn't been funny, he wouldn't have put me on the stage. And I was rock and rolling. I was having a good time. Well, when you're getting that much stage time, you can write a lot of material and you can hone your skills real quick. There's no substitute for just a shit ton of stage time. There's no substitute for that. And I was getting it. I was getting more than my fair share and taking every bit of it. And I was starting to do my first road gigs. I was starting to learn some of the rules of the road, man. I had gotten screwed on some gigs. I paid. I went and did some shows for this guy that everybody called V-Dog. And behind his back, they called him Holler Back At You Later Productions, because without fail, you do a show for the guy and get done and get ready to get your pay. And like, hey, man, I'm going to have to holler back at you later. We didn't make so much money. There's always some line. There's always a story. I got some money coming in from this other thing. It was always. And he'd eventually get you paid, but it was, you know, when you're stuck in McAllen, Texas with $50 in your pocket to get home, it's hard to swallow that pill. And it happened to me a bunch of times. And so all I could think about was, man, if I just take this plane ride out there and hang out with Ralphie, it's going to change my life. Just really what I thought. I really believed it 100%. I'm not going to lie to you, tell you I was too cool to believe that. I was pinning hopes and dreams on that trip with Ralphie. I had that ticket. I carried it around in my pocket for a month. Went and did other shows. Got screwed around on pay here. Screwed around on pay there. Then came the day. I packed my suit up in the best suitcase I have, which was a piece of shit. And shoved my other clothes in there, which my other clothes were mostly work clothes. Drove that little Hyundai to the airport, little Hyundai accent. Drove to the airport, just full of hopes and dreams, just full of, just like a kid, like, man, like I was going to see Willy Wonka or some shit, you know? And just couldn't be more excited. And flew out to Tempe. And when I got to Tempe, I called Ralphie and let them know. I'd already told them what time my flight was coming in. They let me know they were on the way. And I'd never been to Arizona. I hadn't been to Arizona in many years at that point. I had been to Arizona, but I hadn't been there in many years. And I walked outside of the Tempe airport in summer and the sun tried to kill me. Like, I'd never felt heat like that in my life. I felt like I was getting baked inside out. It was insane. That is one of the hottest places I've ever been in my life. It was so crazy. Like, Houston's hot, but it's humid, and it's damp, and sticky. It's different. Out there, they're like, oh, it's a dry heat. All that means is you're in a convection oven. That's what a dry heat is. I don't know if either one of them are better than the other. Everybody's like, it's not the heat. It's humidity. It gets you. Like, I don't know. The heat will get you. The heat is how we cook food. It's how we cook meat. If you put meat in heat long enough, it gets cooked. And, holy cow. Did I feel like I was getting cooked? At that time, every time you seen Ralphie, all he would rent was a Cadillac Escalade because his size, it was a comfortable vehicle for him to get in and drive. And he had to, by God, he was making the money to do it. Dude was killing it. He was selling merch. He was just exploding. He was doing so well. And think about this. This is like the secret y'all don't probably know. You might know, but whatever, for a lot of reasons that everybody claimed to be justified in, comics in Houston just hated him. They were jealous. There were so many of them that were just outwardly jealous and angry. They called him a joke thief. They had everything to say in the world behind his back. He was just a low down dirty dog who just about everybody in my community of comedians, with the exception of a few who were always friends with him. People like my good buddy Slade Ham, buddy Sam Damaris, him were friends. The dude just got hated on. Until He showed up sitting in the lounge in the laugh stop. And then all of a sudden, everybody wanted to be his best friend and hit him up for gigs. And it had to be very lonely and damaging to deal with that. Can't imagine that wouldn't have some kind of effect on your psyche. I mean, he was a tough-skinned dude, obviously, but I just can't believe that didn't affect his psyche some and do some damage to him on an emotional level. I was standing outside that Tempe airport. Here come that Cadillac Escalade. Pulled up. Hey, man. Get in. And I hopped in the back seat where I was greeted by an English bulldog and some other kind of little old dog. I think it was a Chihuahua. I may be wrong about that. It may have been another bulldog. Can't really remember. Those were his dogs. And they traveled with him and went everywhere with him. Lana Taylor, his former wife, was sitting in the passenger seat. I knew Lana also from Houston. I'd met her through my Houston connections. We got along really well. And she was excited for me to be there. And they were so cool. But Ralphie was just busy. He was more business-minded about this business. And he also knew about some things that not everybody knows, but being a big guy or being a heavy guy or being a fat guy, whatever you want to call it, people don't want to put you on camera. They had literally told Ralphie, there's no way you're going to win Last Comic Standing. The only chance you have is getting a standing ovation every night because the network is concerned about your hate, your health, and your weight. They told him that. They used to be more open about it. A friend of mine just recently, he's not even a heavy guy. His agent told him he needed to lose 50 pounds or gain 50 pounds. Like it's kind of insidious. It's a part of this business and it's insidious. They told Ralphie that and Ralphie got a standing ovation every night and they still didn't let him win. Still didn't let him win. You can't tell me that doesn't mess with your brain. Being told you're not allowed to win because of what you look like. It's not acceptable for almost anything else except being a big person. And it's really like that. I've been passed over for things that even though I auditioned well and everything, my size, especially when I was heavier, got me out of the gig. I had an opportunity to be a spokesman for a big car dealership here in Texas one time, and it would have been real good money, and it would have been a good gig for me. And the reason I was given that they backed out was my size at the time. So they didn't think a fat guy was going to be able to convince people to buy cars. If I can't convince you to buy a luxury SUV or a nice pickup, what the hell am I even doing? I pull up, I hop in the back seat. Ralphie's all business. What are you going to wear? Man, I got my suit with me and I got this nice black button-up shirt I can wear on my suit. Your suit black? Yeah. You can't wear black on black on TV. You're not going to pop. You need something that makes you pop. You got blue eyes. So you need a red or a blue shirt. Let's go. Me and Lana are going to buy you a shirt. We're going to take you shopping. They took me to a mall, took me to like a Dillard's or some shit, and bought me this really nice button-up shirt. Really nice button-up. I think it was red, like dark red. We were trying to make sure I popped on camera. He knew all the tricks. He knew all the stuff we needed to do. And then he worked with me on my short set. We were riding around that day. We went, ate food, and him and Lana paid for it. They wouldn't let me pay for anything. The only thing they let me pay for was cigarettes. They said they'd buy me weed, but they weren't buying me cigarettes because they didn't believe cigarette smoke. And I didn't care. You know, I had my cigarettes. But they took care of me. They paid for everything. And not only that, they tipped graciously. They took care of their service people. You know, I've told y'all stories about him and that before, but they were just kind, gracious people. and took me out to nice restaurants, paid for everything. I offered, of course, wouldn't let me pay. No, you're here on our dime. You're here hanging out with us. You're our guest. In so much as I actually stayed in their hotel room. They had like a suite hotel room that had a big, like a fold-out couch in the living room, and then a separate bedroom for them and all that good stuff, and a little kitchen area. And they posted me up. They flopped that bed out for me, and me and Lana fixed that bed up, and I slept on that bed with them dogs, which is kind of funny. I think it was this trip. I hope it was this trip. I may be getting this wrong. Ralphie used to tell a story on stage about his bulldog eating wasabi on accident. Somebody spilled some wasabi and the dog scooped it up before anybody could stop him. I think that this is the trip where that happened. And they had to take that dog to an emergency vet, and they had to get some little bomb that they had put up in the dog's butthole because the dog's butthole was just burnt out from passing that wasabi. So every time the dog had to go outside, I would go with Lana just because it was fun to go walk her. I hadn't been in Arizona much out in the desert. And we'd go hike out a little bit and let the dogs do their business. But that damn dog would just howl and cry while I was trying to pass after the damn wasabi burns. That poor thing. I've never felt so empathetic for another creature in my life. I was like, bro, I've never done wasabi, but I've certainly paid the price of not paying attention to what I put in my mouth and how that was going to feel in the sewage department later on. And that poor dog howled and cried every time it had shit. It was so funny and sad all at the same time. That whole day we're hanging out, Ralphie is working with me on my short set because that's where I'm weak. I'm a storyteller. I need 5-10 minutes. But in these auditions, I found out you only get 3 minutes. And nowadays, sometimes you just get a minute, and I'm much better at it now. But that set, that audition was going to be 3 minutes. I was going to get 3 minutes to rock and roll and make some kind of impression on those judges. And Ralphie helped me with my jokes, helped me tighten them up, even wrote a joke for me about my suit that was just a funny little intro joke, but it got the set rolling right off the bat, and then I could just roll into it. And he worked with me all that day. And then the next morning we got up and we went and ate breakfast. And Lana was auditioning too. Me and Lana both were auditioning. And so then we go over to the improv theater, and there's 400 people waiting outside hoping for a shot. We, of course, were escorted right on through into the building. We're taken backstage with all the other comics who have audition appointments, people whose manager have sent them there, that kind of stuff. I got to meet comics from all over the country. Don't remember any of them's name. I was mostly kind of just like, oh shit, most of these people have been doing comedy a long time. Here I was about a year and a half in total. And I was in here with people who were all 10-year veterans or more. One of the other things that, well, we'll get to that in a little bit. It was something I didn't know at the time. But in my mind, I had just as good a shot as anybody. That's the way I went into it. And I went over my set in my head, and I walked around, and I paced a hole in the floor. And they called my name. When they called my name, I walked out onto that improv stage to a very empty improv with just three people sitting about eight rows up in the back of the room. There's two producers and Ralphie. He's sitting there bullshitting with the producers. They asked me a little bit about myself, who I am, yada, yada, yada. Give them all that. They say, okay, your time starts now. And I did my act for these three people sitting in the back of this huge empty theater, which I cannot tell you how soul crushing that is. I thought I was going to have an audience. I don't know what I thought. I did not know how auditions went at that time. It was shocking. I remember my mouth felt like I'd eat about 50 cotton balls. I felt like I was choking, like I couldn't get the jokes out fast enough. And then I ran through my set in about a minute and a half because I had no feedback and I had never been in that situation before. I just ran through my jokes and they stopped me at about 2 minutes and talked to me a little bit more. Then they said, give us one more bit. And I just happened to have in my head this short bit that I'd been working on that I hadn't fleshed out yet. And I just fumbled my way through that bit and they laughed. They laughed. Ralphie laughed. It was genuine. It came right off the top. You know, it was just something I was working on and it was got to laugh. Boom, boom. They laughed. And then they said, how long have you been doing comedy? And I remember Ralphie like looked at me funny and I said, almost 2 years. And they go, oh, and their expressions changed. And I was like, oh, okay. What was that about? You know, did I just not have enough experience with one of these type things? I didn't let it get in my head. They said they were pleased with my performance and that I would be on the night show, which is where you want to be. The night show is the one that gets filmed. It's your chance to be on national TV. That's the one that gets filmed. That's the one you want to be on. And I just found out I had made it in the night show. Lana also made it into the night show. We leave and we go back to the hotel and me and Ralphie go over my set and him and Lana go over her set and we relax a little bit, and then we put our nice clothes on. We head back to that improv theater. And I must have been nervous. I think I was talking about a mile a minute, you know, and I was just nervous and bouncy back there. And Ralphie said, hey, man, he said, I got to tell you something. He said, they're not going to pick you. And it was like somebody just like popped me, like blew me just. I go, did I do something wrong? He said, man, he said, I didn't think about it. He said, but they're so what happened is the very first year of Last Comic Standing, the guy that won was a comedian named Dat Fan. Dat Fan didn't have a lot of experience when he won the show. And they sent him on tour around the country on the Last Comic Standing tour. And the story goes, I don't know 100%. I wasn't around for that. But this is the story as it's told to me by several people in the industry. Was Dat Fan didn't have 45 minutes of material. He had not been headlining. He had not worked his way up to that part yet. And he hadn't paid those dues. So the story goes is that when Dat Fan got on the road and started having to do these 45 minutes, he started lifting other people's jokes, apparently real bad. And it was a big embarrassment for Last Comic Standing. It was a big embarrassment for the show and the network when it all got called out. So Ralphie tells me all that. And he said, would you be in a year and a half, 2 years in? And then knowing that now, they're not going to be. He said, bro, you can get a standing ovation tonight. And maybe they'll let you go on to the next show, but you're going to get bumped. They're not going to put you on that show. And I was kind of mad at him a little bit, but then I realized he was just looking out for me. He's like, man, I just wanted you to go into this knowing the deal, man. He said, I wish I'd known the deal a bunch of times I went into stuff. And I realized he was just trying to help me. I was a little frustrated and down in the mouth, but we were all laughing by the time we got to the theater. And it did take some pressure off me because all of a sudden now all I got to do is rock and roll. I just want to try to make it on TV tonight. This is where the train ends. Boy, I'm going to do a hell of a show at the end of the train ride. Go backstage. They have us draw numbers to see what order we're going to go in. I think there was 12 comics that night, and I drew 5 or 6, which is just about the best spot in the lineup. You're right in the middle. You don't have to eat the bullet. The crowd's already warmed up, but they're not tired yet. It's the perfect spot, and any lineup in the middle is the perfect spot. That's why being a feature act is so much fun. When you're the guy doing 30 minutes for the headliner, you can thump, baby. and I had that spot. Lana was much later in the lineup than me. I think she was a couple comics, three comics behind me in the lineup. Ralphie was like, man, you got a cool spot. I'm going to go out here and hang with the producers. Place is freaking packed to the gills. He said, do your thing. Every time you see a camera pointed at you backstage, go say something to it. Do whatever you got to do. And sure enough, I put myself in front of the camera every opportunity I got. Had my snakeskin boots on. I was feeling like Diamond Jim, buddy. Had my new fancy shirt on. Hair was popping. I was feeling like I was really, like, I don't know. Just I felt like I was just going to go out there and go for broke. And I was listening to the response. And kind of, I was standing right outside the door in the back of the improv where you wait out in, like, the lobby area. That's where they had us wait while they're getting ready. I listened to comics go up, and some of them did well, some of them didn't do so well. It was a big crowd, but it was a smart crowd, and some of the stuff wasn't flying with them. I remember I made an adjustment to one of my jokes because I heard the way they didn't laugh at something else. Now there's one comic in front of me, and this old boy, I can't remember his name. He had gray hair, but he also had snakeskin boots on. And he was like an old biker from Idaho or some shit. And when I tell you, this dude went up there and knocked them people's socks off, plus he had an accent. So now I'm like, I got nothing to bring to the fight. I got no novelty, no gimmick here. I'm following a guy just like me, just older and better at this job than me. I mean, he really swooped in and knocked him down right in front of me. And I told you, I've always had this theory that when I follow somebody who kills it, I acknowledge it and try to ride that wave. I don't ever make a joke about them. I just acknowledge that they were awesome. Tells the crowd, hey, we're on the same side because we both thought that guy was awesome. Maybe you'll think I'm awesome too. It's a psychology trick. It has worked for me more times, but it's never not worked for me. They called my name to the stage. And I walked down through that crowd of people, and they're all just going nuts. They're still going nuts for the last guy, but they're hyping me up too. And I get up the stage and take the mic, shake the host's hand. And when I tell you I turned around and turned into a chainsaw, I turned around and turned into a chainsaw. I put it on. I got laughs. I acknowledge how great that guy was. It went right into it. 3 minutes of rocking and rolling. This time, I needed the whole 3 minutes for my set, and I was trying to keep from getting disqualified, so I ran just a little bit over 3 minutes closing the deal and hammered them, man. So I tell you, I can still remember what that room felt. There was 400 people in that room, and I hammered them. I brought the goods. I did the work. I walked off that stage feeling good. I walked off that stage feeling like, even though I knew I wasn't going to get picked, they couldn't take a damn thing away from me. They couldn't take a damn thing away from what I'd just done. They could not pick me all they want, but they cannot take that away from me. And did well enough that the comic after me struggled because it throwed them a little bit. Lana did a great job that night as well. And they picked Lana to move on to the next show in Vegas. They, of course, did not pick me, but had wonderful things to say to me. Really nice. Man, we're going to keep you on our radar. And, you know, like, we're going to be keeping an eye on you and your development. And crap, people say it, these things they don't really mean, but sometimes they got to say it. I didn't care. Bought the other head high. Feeling good. And Ralphie told me, he was like, man, I'm so proud of you. He said, the way you handled that, that's the way you handle that. Even if when they tell you you can't win, you still go in there and try to win. And he said, I saw you were trying to win tonight. You were trying to win. And he said, you ain't got a damn thing to feel bad about. You just went up there and rocked it in front of 400 strangers. And he said, you know, I don't know what the episode's going to look like, but there's a good chance you'll be in it, at least for a little bit. Felt good that night. We went out. Ralphie took us all out to a nice dinner. Went and ate some good grub. We smoked some good weed. Next day, we're just kind of hanging out. And Lana said, Ralphie wasn't feeling good. He had just had surgery, or he was recovering from surgery. He had a pump that was like cleaning his wound out. So he was getting winded easy. And he was having some kind of bad health problems at the time. And Lana said, man, I want to go hiking. There's this place over here where everybody goes hiking. You go hiking with me. I was like, hell yeah, man. So me and Lana, we take the dogs and we go hike on all these crazy rocks in Tempe, and we get up real high. We could see all across the desert. It was just a cool moment. And Lana was just the whole time just giving me advice about the business, giving me advice about who to not get tangled up with, giving me advice about how to take things like this and how to take them in stride. She was very supportive and kind to me the entire time. She thought I'd had an amazing set, thought I'd gone in there and really put it through. And she's like, Ralphie's definitely going to give you more work. You're going to work with Ralphie more. And I did. It going to work with Ralphie many more times. But I didn't even want to go back to Houston. I was loving that scene out there. Ralphie would say one of the funniest things. I was a chubby guy, but the girls out there were giving me looks, and the girls were gorgeous and tippy, you know? Yeah, he said, this is a college town. He said, eights don't even get talked to, bro. He's like, you could do well in a town like this. He just about had me convinced to move out there at one point, you know? Because it was a lot of comics were moving to Tempe, and it was close enough to L.A. You could drive in for auditions. He just about had me convinced. They took me to the airport the next day. I flew back to Houston. Didn't hear from him for a few months. He was busy on the road, and I was having to, you know, get back after work and stuff like that. And the night the episode aired, the owner of the Laugh Stop was all excited because I'd been out there. So the night the Tempe episode aired, he put it on the projector in the lounge, and we all sat around and saw me on stage for about 6 seconds. They showed me getting ready to walk down to go to the stage, and they showed my cowboy boots and my suit and me being a little anticipatory. And then they showed me deliver like half a punchline of 5 seconds in the crowd. You didn't even hear the first part of the punchline. You just heard me end the punchline and the crowd roar. And then they were on to the next comic they were going to show or whatever. But my mama, while she was alive, saw me on national TV, thanks to Ralphie May. Even if it was just for 5 seconds, I would never be able to pay that favor back to him, and certainly can't now. But I try to do so by paying tribute and honoring his memory, because he was just a really good dude, and I have nothing but really good things to say about him. My mama got to see me on national TV. That was because of Ralphie. You know, and no, nothing ever came out of that. In fact, I went and auditioned for Last Comic Standing the next year. And same thing, got an audition, an agent audition on the inside. And there my dreams were quelled by a comedian named Alonzo Bowden. And I don't hold it against him. I got my revenge sometime later. But yeah, man. The craziest thing about that was Ralphie knew all those people shit talked to him. Ralphie, everybody put it in his ear. Ralphie knew how those people talked about him all the time. He knew all of it. And he told me this more than two or three times, and I didn't listen to him, but he'd say, get out of Houston, man. I don't like to see talent go bad on the vine. And if you stay around all these bitter some bitches here, you're going to end up one of them. You got to get out of Houston. Tell me that all the time. These days, I'm still in Houston, but I don't spend a lot of time around the bitter people. I don't like that negative energy around me. So I did learn a little something from it. Let's wrap it up right there. Hope you guys enjoyed that. Let's do some testimonials from last week's show about the Dodge Ram and old Skip. Boy, old Skip was a good dude. I really enjoyed doing that episode. All right, our old buddy, Mike Fleisner, 4415. Definitely a day oneer. He's been watching the show and comment always. Please, more Papaw Uncle Wrenching. Barb is making chicken and dumplings. I do, I wrote Shop Talk 28, the new sketch with Papaw and Dad and Uncle. And I have not had an opportunity to film it because every time I sit out in the yard to film it, we have a thunderstorm. It's been storming here every day. There's a certain time of summer where if you're anywhere close to the city, I think it's because of the way the clouds hit the heat from the concrete, there's going to be a storm every day. And just about the time that'd be the right time of day for me to go film it because the sun and the light, we've been having a storm every day. It's also why I mowed my yard right before we went to Colorado. And I have not got to mow it since then because it's been storming and my grass is over a foot tall. It's insane. It's seeding right now. I'm going to try to get it mowed tomorrow while I'm fussing around working on the book. I got some book stuff. I got a bunch of book work to do tomorrow. More shop talk. But I'm really happy about this one I've written and I'm really looking forward to filming it. At PBR Street Gang 69. Your powers of observation over Mopars and their owners is uncanny, JW. If Dodge made refrigerators, I would be extolling the benefits of warm beer to you right now. Hell yeah, brother. I know. I was raised by a broke Mopar bin. I get it. I think I'm secretly a Mopar guy. I hate to admit it. I do secretly love Mopar. It's probably why I give them the most shit. At James Nauman. JW, thank you for all you are doing with the Hot Wheels drive for those kids. I know they will enjoy them. I wish I was in the position to make a few donations, but it makes me happy to see the donations have been made already and knowing the lives that will be touched from this. Bro, that's the way I'm not doing this. You know, it's the people that can afford to help out and do this. I'm very appreciative of it. It does. You know what, man? Let's just open this box. James, I'm with you, man. It just makes me happy knowing what kind of fun thing we're going to do with this. And I got to finish. I have somebody. I like these to be a surprise for me, but I have somebody that checks these packages to make sure there's not pranks or glitter bombs and that kind of shit. So they usually have to open them a little bit. So they can look inside and crack the seal. Only because years ago, I saw a YouTuber opening something get really hurt because somebody played a really nasty prank on them. And I don't want to feel that way of anybody. Both these boxes, there's another huge box. And then this box come to us courtesy of Mississippi sports fan, Lindenhurst, NY, shipped to Palace Theater, courtesy of Jerry Wayne Longmire. But Palace Theater, if you don't know, that's where I'm going, Macomb, Mississippi. I'm going there in November, I believe. I'm going to Macomb, Mississippi. I'm really excited about that show because I'm going to be just a few miles down the road from where one of my legends, my heroes, Jerry Clower is buried. So I'm going to make the pilgrimage to go out there and see the greatest Jerry of all time's graveside and pay some small tribute best I can. Maybe I'll make a little video, start writing this thing about him. I'm so sorry. I got a mustache here trying to climb up in my nostrils. And look at here, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, God dang it. It just makes me smile. Just a box full of Hot Wheels. double stacked in there. Double stacked. I don't know how many are in here. Look at that cool ass van. Ain't that neat? We are about to just make some kitty smile, and I'm just really excited about that. Look at that big old full box of Hot Wheels. That house theater. It's helped get to me for our big day of giving in October. I'm literally going to have to buy a storage building to store all these. This is amazing. And then this giant box that is very heavy. And also, gears. I know I'm cutting towards me, but I'm an old pro. And I got a few. Schmutz on my blade. Icky schmutz. What have we here, ladies and gentlemen? Three more boxes inside it. Holy cow. Okay. I'm not going to open all these. But I suspect what we have here. More. Where's this is from Powell's Theater too. Oh, this also from Mississippi Sports Fan. Mississippi, I think it's Sports Fan. Up in Lindenhurst, New York, but through the Palace Theater in Macomb, Mississippi, got this to me. This is amazing. I don't know. Pretty sure this is from the people at the Palace Theater. They are really excited about my show. I'm really excited about my show. I came about that show because of you guys, because some of y'all who were fans in Mississippi went and talked to this theater and said, why aren't you guys booking this guy? And they contacted my management, and we've set up a date. Biggest theater I have played to date. I think it seats 600. I don't have any misgivings that I'm about to sell 600 tickets, but I sure would like to sell 200 or 300, you know, and have me a big old nice room full of people to do my acting. Every one of these boxes also full of Hot Wheels. I just love this. I've got to do, I'm so busy right now, but I got to get out here and get a count of these things. Twang thing. Love it. Love it. Just Hot Wheels make me smile already. And I'm so excited about what we're doing with these. You guys just, I'm telling you, you have no idea what a dark place my heart was in over them stupid cats. Should probably stop calling them stupid cats, but I just can't believe I was this upset. I'm just trying to make myself feel better. My heart was in a very dark place after that incident and thinking lots of dark thoughts and angry thoughts. And it's just, you guys just made me smile. And I thank you for that. It's a beautiful thing. All right, let's wrap this thing up. You know, y'all got supper to eat, and places to go, people to see, that sort of thing. I got to get in there and get this thing edited. So you guys can watch it tomorrow, Saturday. I waited the last minute to do this. I wasn't really feeling good either. Probably should have done it earlier. I wanted to tell y'all that story so that you understand where I'm coming from when I say that I don't count on things until they're happening. Now, I've had lots of exciting phone calls this week, and there's a lot of things up in the air that could very well happen. And if they do, they will change the trajectory of my career and my life in a big way, I think. But to me, it's not real until I got a check in my hand and a date. You know what I mean? Or whatever the shit I need. But people are very excited about my book. And I'm tickled to death about it because hillbillies get movie deals and they get music deals, but you don't often hear about hillbillies getting book deals. Usually they write a book about them after they're dead. I am a hillbilly that's been given an actual publishing deal with a very cool publisher that publishes some really neat stuff. So it's, I just couldn't be more thankful for Adam. Adam's looking at the Wrecking Yard and deciding that it was something worthy of being in print has changed my life a great deal. And I'm not sure I'll ever be able to pay that debt to him. Very thankful. And you know, I've had a lot of doors shut. Folks get pretty scared when they hear a door slam shut. When you're pinning your hopes and dreams on something, it's like it's the end of the story. It's like that one door was the only path forward, and now the whole road's blocked. I used to think that way myself. In Tempe, I was very much thinking that way. When I came back to Tempe, I very much kind of had that attitude. Like, well, that didn't happen. I guess I'm going to have to figure out some other way. I used to think that way myself. Every time a door closed, I'd stand there staring at it, feeling like I'd been left behind or like I'd failed somehow. But the older I get, the more I see it differently. Not every door closing is a tragedy. Sometimes it's protection. Sometimes it's a delay for your own good. Hell, sometimes it's the universe. Make sure you don't walk into something you're not ready for or that's not ready for you. And I've learned that time and time again, things that I thought were going to be good for me that I didn't get, and I was disappointed about them, and then I watched them not turn out good for other people. I've had jobs I thought I wanted slip through my fingers. I've lost relationships I thought were forever. I've missed out on gigs, on deals, on so-called big breaks. And every single time, I thought my whole world was caving in. Every single time. But if those doors had stayed open, I might have walked through them too soon. I might have found a version of success that I wasn't built to handle yet. Or worse, a version of me that I wouldn't like very much today. Sometimes a closed door ain't a punishment. It's a pause. It's a chance to build yourself up a little more. To learn, to heal, to get ready for something better. And sometimes you're meant quit staring at the same damn door and turn around and build your own. So if you're out there feeling like your path is blocked or that life is slamming doors in your face, I reckon you should hang in there. I'm living proof that if you just keep hanging in there, your time's coming. I'm rooting for you. There's room. I tell you this. I'm gonna tell it to you so many times that you can't believe anything else. I'm going to say it so many times that it's drilled in your brain. I'm rooting for you. There's room at the table for everybody. And when the right door opens, you will be ready. I'm JW. I love you. Oh, y'all need hot wheels. I tell you what, man. I might figure out a way to display them all. Maybe stack them up like a pyramid of fun.